Good day. My name is Joe Lockhart. I'm talking today about secular sacred tensions in antebellum abolitionist songbooks. A small body of anti-slavery songbooks published in the decades leading up to the Civil War represents an intersection between anti-slavery poetry and the traditions of public hymn singing. This corpus of songbooks and hymnals constituted a little remembered but vibrant oppositional element within Jacksonian political culture. The anthology politics of these songbooks, as I shall briefly illustrate, lie in the tensions between secular and evangelical Christian purposes. Although these American songbooks emerged from and adapted materials from religious hymnals, within a few years, they separated themselves from these origins. The first anti-slavery songbook published in the United States was Maria Weston Chapman's Songs of the Free and Hymns of Christian Freedom, which appeared in 1836. Chapman, dedicated to organizing and publicizing Garrisonian abolitionism, framed this book's purpose in the following words, and I quote, "Those who are laboring for the freedom of the American slave have felt their need of aid, which has ever been sought by those in all ages who have striven for the good of their race, the encouragement, consolation, and strength afforded by poetry and music. This generally expressed feeling was the origin of the present book of hymns, with the accompanying strain of poetry, hardly less elevated, though more ornamented and diffuse, than is allowed by the severe beauty and sublimity that should model the Christian lyric." End quote. The anti-slavery hymnal, Chapman continued, would be a tool for spiritual warfare and, through a sanctification of aesthetic faculties, provide recognition of the fraternity of all humanity in messianic faith. However, the manifest differences of ideological origin appear in the specification of an aesthetic difference between, quote, simple religious music and more, quote, ornamental, topical music. This ideological separation represented at heart a contest over the social construction of evangelical Protestantism in the antebellum United States, and specifically its willingness or unwillingness to confront the issue of slavery. Chapman sought to close that separation and expand the appeal of the abolitionist movement through the cultural familiarity of hymn singing. Her book was a true potpourri of musical sources and texts, combining hymns by Isaac Watts and John Wesley, together with poetry by contemporary figures such as William Lloyd Garrison, Elizabeth Margaret Chandler, William Cullen Bryant, and Chapman herself. This mixture was provocative of itself, for slaveholders shared these same religious hymns and reacted angrily to hearing of their use for anti-slavery politics. Lydia Maria Child describes, for instance, one political and legal problem encountered by the organizers of public meetings to celebrate British emancipation of slaves in its Caribbean colonies on August 1, 1834. Quote, "The planters had a law of constructive treason," she wrote, "that doomed any man to death who made use of language tending to excite a desire for liberty among the slaves. And they found treason in the Bible, and sedition in the hymns of Watts and Wesley, and we had to be very careful about how we used them." Thus, provided with an anti-slavery context, even the spirituality of Wesley and Watts' hymns could be construed as incitement. Two anti-slavery hymnals published in the early 1840s followed a similar pattern as Chapman's Songs of the Free by mixing sacred and secular materials. Jairus Lincoln's Anti-Slavery Melodies appeared in 1843, followed by George W. Clark's Liberty Minstrel in 1844. A strong shift towards secularization can be noted, though, in William Wells Brown's The Anti-Slavery Harp, published in 1848. Brown compiled his songbook with more focus on fulfilling market demand. He wrote, quote, the demand of the public for a cheap anti-slavery songbook containing songs of a more recent composition has induced me to collect together and to present to the public the songs contained in this book." End quote. While Brown borrowed to a limited extent from the Lincoln and Clark song anthologies, its 48 anti-slavery songs are emphatically topical. There are no Watts or Wesley hymns here. Instead, there are poems from newspapers, abolitionist rally songs, and protest anthems against fugitive renditions back into slavery and anathematizing slave auctions. The invocation of Christianity, as in the song "The Fugitive Slave to the Christian," whose chorus asks, quote, "O Christian, will you send me back?" end quote, arrives largely in terms of rhetorical challenges to unfulfilled promises of freedom and spiritual equality within Christianity. Where Chapman's Songs of the Free exhibits a divided mind over spirituality and temporality, Brown's anti-slavery harp resolves this conflict in favor of temporality. Examining dedicated anti-slavery hymnals for their ideological construction is only one aspect of the publication of anti-slavery music. Anti-slavery hymns appeared before Chapman published the first U.S. dedicated hymnals, but these songs remain unassembled. When they were assembled, it was in limited sections within general hymnals. Church hymnals in circulation within those denominations officially opposed to slavery might include a few select anti-slavery songs among scores or even hundreds of hymns. This practice continued throughout the antebellum period. Typically, as in the popular and much reprinted Unitarian Book of Hymns for Public and Private Devotion, a reader would encounter Eliza Folan's Prayer for the Slave and John Greenleaf Whittier's Freedom, along with several more scattered hymns having anti-slavery import. Such items were included, however, in the supplementary sections of a hymnal at the end of a volume, together with hymns on topics such as the harvest, funerals, missions, and martyrs. Much of this general reluctance to include anti-slavery songs in hymnals arose because of widespread perception that their publication in such volumes breached a barrier between secular and sacred domains. Moreover, hymns that condemn slavery might be read as anathematizing the wicked rather than only wickedness, violating Christian injunctions to mercy. According to one standard work on hymnology published in 1860, quote, "We must think it puts in jeopardy the spirituality of worship, especially in our own day and country, in which political passions are rampant and denunciation of rulers needs no stimulus." End quote. Thus, just as imprecations from the Psalms were eliminated from hymns, so too were specific condemnations to be avoided. Instead of condemnation, according to this concept of appropriate hymn choice, divine powers of justice should be worshipped. The hymnologist Austin Phelps wrote, quote, "Has the supreme judiciary at the Capitol given a blow to freedom which reverberates through the land? Has the national legislature struck down a barrier against slavery? We would improve such a calamity by singing strains like these. Dread Jehovah, God of nations, see, gracious God, before thy throne. On thee, O Lord our God, we call. O Lord, our fathers oft have told, great shepherd of thine Israel." This more conservative position, while opposed to slavery, opposed the role of hymn singing as rising above the immediacies of political opposition in order to invoke salvation through divine protection of the faithful. Austin Phelps, the author of this position and a congregational minister, held a teaching appointment at the most orthodox Calvinist of institutions and over theological seminary. When Phelps published his own Sabbath hymn book in 1858, he followed his own advice and included only two hymns that made oblique reference to slavery. Phelps, who was to spend a decade as president of the prestigious Andover Seminary, was typical of many Northern clergy who accounted themselves as anti-slavery but resolutely excluded these sentiments from their church practices. What self-censorship did not achieve, institutional censorship could and did accomplish. It became a matter of public comment, for instance, that a pro-slavery figure in the Presbyterian Church omitted, quote, a single verse of a certain hymn containing anti-slavery sentiments, end quote. To be fair, the exclusion of anti-slavery hymns from hymnals was not entirely limited to theological or social conservatives. Some determined abolitionists simply felt that such songs were out of place in a hymnal. For example, James Freeman Clark, a leading Garrisonian abolitionist, permitted only one slavery song, that was Anti-Slavery Meeting by James Russell Lowell, in his service book for the use of the Church of the Disciples, published 1844. Other general hymnals from the antebellum decades took a more substantive view of the role of anti-slavery hymns. Cyrus Prindle's 1846 Methodist hymnals, for example, included a solid section of 28 anti-slavery hymns within a selection of over 750 hymns. Prindle's inclusion of this 20-page section assuredly recommended the collection to its publisher, Orange Scott, one of the leaders of the 1844-1845 Methodist schism over slavery. The 1847 Baptist hymnal, Sacred Melodies for Conference and Prayer Meetings, adopted a similar strategy, creating a separate 13-poem anti-slavery section in a volume of 266 hymns. The hymnal's unknown compilers demonstrated their critique of the United States by including the song, My country 'tis of thee, stronghold of slavery, of thee I sing, sung, of course, to the tune of America. Ironically, this radical voice, found in the midst of a general hymnal, joined a church hymnal to ex-slave William Wells Brown's abolitionist songbook and its demands for immediate liberation of African American slaves. If a secular sacred tension had created the anti-slavery songbook at the same time, that tension inflected and altered the social conscience of general church hymnals through recognition that hymns could respond to worldly injustices. Thank you.